Grindvold Financial Group.
Hour two of your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. #250 on any mobile device, and just saying TCNT will also work.
We are going to work through the audio that we have of the debate last night. We got a lot of guests on the show this morning. It's been a while since we've talked to... I think it's safe to say that Devin Foley is our education expert. He's our go-to education guru from Intellectual Takeout.
Yeah, well, we can call him that.
Among other things, he's a fantastic guest.
Absolutely.
He's going to talk about canceling the debt. There's a lot of talk about that last night during the debate. Representative Steve Drazkowski will talk Ilhan Omar at 7:35 when he calls in. If you go to TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and the Justice and Drew page, you can see a fantastic video of Ilhan Omar not answering any questions being asked of her. It's hysterical.
Yeah.
We were just having a conversation off the air about that. That's not how you act if you are not guilty of doing something. You push back, you fight.
Exactly. And we were comparing it to, you know, look how she's handled these scandals and these allegations and accusations, and compare it to how Trump has responded to the entire Russia collusion narrative and an idea that he and his campaign somehow conspired with Russian agents to swing the election. You know, he pushed back and he fought. And he called it all nonsense, and he called it all a hoax, and he continues to call it those things. And everybody takes that, and then they gaslight and say, well, you know, if you were innocent, he wouldn't be pushing back so hard. No. No, if you get accused of something that you know you didn't do, you push back, you fight. What has Ilhan Omar done this entire time?
Yeah, she just...
What are we hearing from her and her surrogates?
Yeah, she ignores all of it. You know, we'll get into that with the representative Drazkowski coming up at 7:35. But that's my view, and especially if you're Ilhan Omar, she doesn't hold back in what she's saying. You know, and I understand if it's something that's hasn't been substantiated, if there hasn't been any investigation or stuff like that, or it's just totally completely over the top and ludicrous. But the evidence is out there. Mm-hmm. She's already been busted on some other minor fronts. And so it would be incredibly easy, and I think it would be relevant if you're being, badgered by a reporter walking in Washington, D.C., heading to your next destination, and they're asking you, you know, can you definitively say that if he's your brother or not, why wouldn't you just stop and go, no, of course he's not my brother. For crying out loud, now leave me alone.
Why would I marry my brother?
Right. She just keeps on walking.
No. Yeah. I would, if somebody accused me of marrying my brother.
Yeah.
I would be beyond incredulous.
You have to watch the video to see it. But there's a moment in the video where they end up walking. She's surrounded by a lot of her aides, Ilhan Omar is, as she's being followed, you know, by this individual with a microphone, and they're recording it. And the individual questioning her says, you're heading to blank. Like, you can hear Ilhan's having a conversation with one of her aides, and they're a little bit confused over where they're going. And the guy goes, we're going to the legal building. And Ilhan looks up and smiles at him, like laughing that he knew where they were going. And again, I'm reading way too much into this, but if you're being hounded over false accusations that you know aren't true by an individual that won't let it go, you don't look at them and start laughing at them making a comment. It's not funny. That's not funny. This isn't interesting. You're being hounded and badgered over something if it's not true. Right. And again, I'm reading too much into it. This is my opinion. But Ilhan Omar certainly doesn't bite her tongue on any other level.
Right.
When it comes to anything else.
I know. Yeah, she's quick to clap back on just about anything, except on this issue, she's been oddly quiet. Almost like legally advised quiet.
Yeah, yeah, that's...
It almost feels like somebody's advising her to be quiet.
You think? Just maybe?
Maybe. I could be going out on a limb here.
All right. We'll get into Amy Klobuchar, right? An American TV viewer, spent two full hours watching the first Democratic presidential debate Wednesday night, and they got a little over 8 minutes of Amy Klobuchar. Let's start here, because we're going to work through this piece. We've got a lot of audio to play, and let's kick things off first with, these are all the candidates, the Democratic candidates responding to who they think is the Biggest geopolitical threat in the United States right now.
Who is the geopolitical threat to the United States? Just give me a one-word answer, Congressman Delaney.
Could you repeat the question?
Greatest geopolitical threat to the United States right now, Congressman Delaney.
Well, the biggest
Who's Congressman Delaney?
That is former Maryland Congressman John Delaney.
That's a really good point.
Did he sneak onto the stage, or was he invited?
I didn't know you. I don't know.
I don't even know.
The political challenge is China, but the biggest geopolitical threat remains nuclear weapons.
Okay.
Right? So those are different questions.
Totally get it. Go ahead, Governor Inslee.
The biggest threat to the security of the United States is Donald Trump.
What? There's no question.
Congressman Gabbard.
The greatest
geopolitical threat.
The greatest threat that we face is the fact that we are at a greater risk of nuclear war today than ever before in history.
Senator
Klobuchar. Two threats, economic threat, China, but our major threat right now is what's going on in the Mideast with Iran if we don't get our
try to keep it at one, slimmer than what we've been going here. One or two words.
Our existential threat is climate change. We have to confront it before it's too late.
Senator Warner. Yeah.
Climate change.
Yeah, Senator Booker.
Nuclear proliferation and climate change.
Secretary Castro.
China and climate change.
Yeah, Congressman Ryan.
China, without a question, they're wiping us around the world economically.
And Mr. Mayor.
Russia, because they're trying to undermine our democracy, and they've been doing a pretty damn good job of it, and we need to stop them.
China, in my opinion, is the only relevant answer in any of those ones.
And it's fascinating to hear them all answer China, and think about that for a minute. Like, how did China get to this point? What policies did we have that enabled China to get to this point for so long? It's not like China became a threat in the last 2 years.
Right.
Right? This has been growing and growing and growing for a long time, and you have never had leadership in Washington that was willing to make some tough decisions, and actually decisions that might cause some pain to the American consumer, to deal with the trade imbalance and the economic threat that China has become. What is Donald Trump trying to do? He's trying to deal with it. He's trying to solve it. And everything he does gets completely lambasted. You would think if these guys had their way, Donald Trump would be doing nothing.
Yeah.
When it comes to China, and the trade imbalances would still be there. He was the only one in 2016 out of all the candidates that was running on dealing with the trade imbalances with China.
I'm going to keep an open mind on a couple of things. And there was something really interesting in that audio piece, and it's hard to know because you don't know what the demographic is. But the question being the biggest geopolitical threat, the thing that got the most, I mean, that crowd went nuts when whoever it was, I don't even know who it was, whoever it was said it was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
The crowd just went crazy. And I...
Yeah, they believe that.
Yeah, I can absolutely be wrong. I tend to be of the opinion that the majority of the American public, even if you're the majority of the liberal Democrat American public, like, knows better than that. Maybe I'm wrong. Because that was really interesting to me. And I know it's a debate and there's people there to see the debate. But the fact that the crowd cheered as hard as they did for something that is... just a really, like, the most nonsensical statement, right, being a geopolitical threat. I'm going to keep an open mind on whether or not, I think you're, because I'm more of the opinion they're going to pick somebody like a Biden who's more moderate. But, Drew, you know, I know you kind of lean more towards it being somebody on the identity politics extreme side of things. And based off of just that.
Yeah. If that crowd is any indication of the Democratic primary base, then they're going to pick the candidate that throws the most effective and hardest punches at Trump.
We got a couple of clips in regards to guns. We'll start first with Amy Klobuchar.
Let me give 30 seconds. Senator Klobuchar, Iron Range, I'm curious. Gun confiscation, right? If the government is buying back, how do you not have that conversation?
Well, that's not confiscation. You would give them the offer to buy back their gun. But I'll say this. I look at these proposals and I say, does this hurt my Uncle Dick and his gear stand, coming from a proud hunting and fishing state? These proposals don't do that. When I was a prosecutor, I supported the assault weapon ban. When I was in the Senate, I saw those moms from Sandy Hook come and try to advocate for change, and we all failed. And then, now, these Parklandkins from Florida, they started literally a national shift. You know why? It's just like with gay marriage. When kids talk to their parents and their grandparents, they say, I don't understand why we can't put these sensible things in place. I say, listen, and all if right. we get bested by Senator, a bunch of 17-year-olds, it's the best thing
Senator,
that ever happened.
Thank you.
We need
Senator,
to get
Senator, thank you.
Does it hurt my Uncle Dick in his deer stand? That's what she... can you unpack that for me? Does this hurt my Uncle Dick in his deer stand? It's her Uncle Dick test. That's what it is. They even have it in the Pioneer Press.
Uncle Dick litmus test.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
She's trying to say, was it going to take away his hunting rifles?
Her anecdotes with her family are so confusing. Like, I mean, at least it wasn't about her drunk dad.
Now
we've moved over to Uncle Dick, for crying out loud. I can't wait to hear more Uncle Dick stories.
Does she even have an Uncle Dick? I don't even know.
It's a very, very good
It's probably
point.
Made up.
Elizabeth Warren was asked a similar question.
We need to treat this like the virus that's killing our children.
You didn't address, do you think the federal government needs to go and figure out a way to get the guns that are already out there?
We need to treat it like a serious research problem, which we have not done. Okay. You know, guns in the hands of a collector who's had them for decades, who's never fired them, who takes safety seriously, that's very different from guns that are sold and turned over quickly. We can't treat this as an across-the-board problem. We have to treat it like a public health emergency. That means bring data to bear, and it means make real change in this country, whether it's politically popular or not.
Senator Booker, you have a pro...
It's not, though.
No. It's not. Oh, man.
And the fact that she's dancing around the question, you know, and she's trying to pin the responsibility on, you know, these researchers. We need to research it. We need to treat it like a public health crisis. We need data so that she doesn't have to be the one responsible for making the decision. What she wants is gun confiscation. She's basically said as much in a roundabout way, but now that she's on a national stage and she knows how poorly that plays on a big, broad national stage like that, she has to dance around and she has to say, no, we need data and research. What's that research? That research is going to come back and say, yeah, we should probably confiscate guns.
Yeah.
Of course it is, because that's what she wants to do. So that's the research she's going to look at.
Do you think, how much of the conversation with these candidates, when they're, you know, with their focus groups and when they're looking at polling data and all that, how much of the conversation is Trump's going to win next year? Like, I'm how much of the fact that we have so many candidates, right, and that they're debating so early, it's not being talked about, but I get this underlying tone that so much of this is not about this election. Like, I feel like these individuals, at least the majority of them, know that they have no shot at, even if they got the nomination, that they've got no shot of beating Trump unless something drastically changes with the economy. There are certain economic indicators that currently Trump right now has ticked off all the check marks on that pretty much say that he's insured to win next year. Now, granted, we're saying the fact that we're way, way early on in all of this, so anything's possible. As of right now, if the election is held tomorrow, he wins in a landslide regardless of who ends up getting it.
I think you're right.
So I'm very curious how many of these individuals, this is not even about 2020. How much of this, because they're all relatively young, apart from Biden, right? They're all most likely going to be around. I mean, maybe this is Amy Klobuchar's super long game, knowing she can hold her seat here for as long as she wants, and she's setting up for when Trump is done, and they have to go up against a different Republican candidate.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case for Amy, but I would venture to say that's the case for some of these candidates, because you're right, they are young, and they have to be aware of their lack of name recognition. They have to be aware of how poorly they're polling compared to the front runners and what an uphill battle that is. So yeah, if you're like a Beto O'Rourke or a Julian Castro...
Or Tulsi Gabbard.
Tulsi Gabbard is a good example, or... any of the three or four random guys up there that all look and sound alike and whose names I'm not even going to bother learning.
Right?
Like those guys, right. You know, you're right. They could be looking at this of, all right, you know, I'm going to spend some time in this primary process, build up my name ID, and then, you know, I'll try to keep myself relevant and on the cable talk shows over the next few years, and that'll set me up nicely for a run in 2024.
I would advise everybody to keep an eye on tonight's debate. And I'm certainly going to watch tonight's debate with different eyes based off of this, because I think that you can tell. I think you can tell in responses the individuals who legitimately feel like the ones who are way more authentic and sounding less like they're pandering, like Tulsi Gabbard did. Honestly, I don't agree with her politically, like at all.
I don't agree with her politically, but I do think she's one of the more authentic and genuine candidates out there.
And I think for those individuals, I think those ones that come across like that are more likely playing the long game because they know, hey, you know what? I'm just going to let everybody know right now who I am. I know I don't have a shot of winning the primary and that none of us really have a shot of beating Trump. So I'm just going to do my best to let everybody know who I genuinely am and what I stand for so that I can position myself for, you know, after Trump is done when his time in office is over.
651-989-5855, Lance in Minneapolis. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. I was telling Sam that the one thing about the Democrats, if you compare them to the Republicans, it doesn't matter how many Democrats that are running, they'll find a way to unify, they'll find a way to coexist, and they'll back each other up. Look at Bernie Sanders, how he got picked on by Hillary, and he never stuck up for himself either, which I couldn't believe it.
You might be right, Lance, but there's a different dynamic at play here that the Bernie Sanders phenomenon started in the last cycle and I think is going to continue into this cycle. That extreme progressive wing of the Democratic base, I don't think they'll unify. I don't know how big it is, but there's an extreme progressive base out there that wants the Bernie Sanders. They want the most socialist candidate. And if they don't get what they want, and if they feel like the DNC worked against that candidate's interests, I don't think they'll show up.
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. The first thing that popped in, and Lance is right. Usually they do unify, and we could be wrong, but there is so much division among the left right now in so many different subgroups. And even when you look at pop culture, Melinda hadn't seen the video for You Need to Calm Down, hadn't known any of the controversy last night, so I was showing it to her. We were having a conversation about it. And, you know, you look at pop culture and the way that they're even going after sort of their own, sort of the lack of wokeness or taking advantage of the LGBTQ community. You look at Antifa. I think they're all too fractured right now. I think there's going to be several different sub-bases of the progressive Democrats that whoever gets the nomination, they're going to be really, really ticked off that it wasn't their person. And those groups have gotten substantially bigger over the course of the past few years.
651-989-5855. Several people want to chime in on this. If you are on hold, please stay on hold. We will get to your calls. Also be joined by Devin Foley from
3.5 FM.
We know that not everyone is sharing in this prosperity, and Donald Trump just sits in the White House and gloats about what's going on when you have so many people that are having trouble affording college and having trouble affording their premiums. So I do get concerned about paying for college for rich kids. I do. But I think my plan is a good one. And my plan would be to, first of all, make community college free. And make sure that everyone else besides that top percentile gets help with their education. My own dad and my sister got their first degrees with community college. There's many paths to success, as well as certifications. Secondly, I'd use Pell Grants. I'd double them from $6,000 to $12,000 a year and expand it to the number of families that get covered, to families that make up to $100,000. And then the third thing I would do is make it easier for students to pay off their student loans. Because I can tell you this, if billionaires can pay off their yachts, students should be able to pay off their student loans.
What? We're listening to...
No!
This is Twin Cities News Talk. Twin Cities News Talk, Justice and Drew. I find it funny that the song is Rhythm Nation, and all I kept thinking was, Broke Nation. So that we would be under any of their plans and ideas.
You know what? I bet if everybody was as broke as Amy Klobuchar is going to end up trying to make them, we wouldn't have any more fun songs like this to dance to. So.
She's being slightly more sensible than the rest of them are.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
She actually is. That's kind of scary.
She's like one of the more moderate ones.
Joining us now, friend of the show, been far too long since we've had the opportunity to chat with him, Devin Foley from Intellectual Takeout. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
doing great, guys. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Well, yeah, you know, you were top of mind over the course of the past few days, Devin, to be honest with you, because, you know, listening to all this nonsense about the canceling of the debt, you're kind of at least in my mind, you're kind of our education guru. And I thought several times working through the stories of, I wonder what Devin Foley thinks about this. So, you know, kind of default to you. When you've got Bernie Sanders out there, Ilhan Omar, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, talking about canceling student debt. You know, Amy Klobuchar is offering up a slightly more moderate idea, but curious to get your take. I mean, do you have any hair left? Have you pulled all of it out?
I've got a little bit hair left, more so because I've got a 15 going on 16-year-old, and I'm staring down debt now, and I'm like, oh, my God.
I know what that feels like.
Insanity. And that, I think, is really where I start with is, you know, you look at the cost of college. None of this addresses why college has risen so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you an example. So Cato did a report, and they compared 1980 tuition to 2010 tuition in 2010 dollars. To give you a sense of how much things have changed, because you hear from a lot of boomers who say, well, I was able to work my way through college and it was fine. Right. So $1,980 for, say, the Pennsylvania State University, tuition in 1980 and 2010 dollars, $4,272. Tuition in 2010, $17,344. What changed? And these plans don't address any of that. Mm-hmm. The flip side is we do have a lot of kids out there who are just getting ground to dust coming out of college. I mean, I see kids coming into my shop who have $85,000, $100,000 in school debt. I mean, they essentially have a second mortgage. But, of course, what we do, the bankruptcy laws changed in this country, too, so that these kids couldn't go bankrupt and get rid of their school debt. So there's the whole market is completely out of whack. You have massive government subsidies. You then have the inability of these kids to get out of debt or to, you know, release themselves of the debt. And then, of course, for the lenders to be punished for making bad loans. And so the whole system's completely top to bottom a disaster. So that's my thinking. And then, of course, hopefully it all changes in the next 2 to 3 years before my kid gets there.
Well, and it's a disaster, and nobody wants to really address why it's a disaster. What has caused all these tuitions to skyrocket? Why do all of these state-run institutions feel that they are justified and that it's necessary to jack up the tuitions? It's because these colleges are absolutely bloated with administrative salaries, with high professor salaries, and they won't do anything about them. This is there's union involvement, there's union payoffs. You want to fix the college debt problem. You want to fix the cost of college. You want to fix all the students that are coming out of college with insurmountable debt. Make college cheaper. You don't just do that, though, by saying it's going to be free and we're going to cover it with tax dollars. No. Go to these institutions and say, all right, you know, you're going to have a major, major budget cut. We need to eliminate some of these administrative salaries. We need to eliminate some of these programs, some of these majors, some of these classes that don't offer any real value to the students when they get out of college. Get them back focused on what they are supposed to be doing, which is educating kids in a field that will lead to some gainful employment.
Right. And that's what you're seeing. And I mean, to your point, you put free money out there, people are going to use it up. And, you know, what I think is truly reprehensible is, again, there's no talk of what about the universities? What about their spending? What about their, to your point, truly bloated administrative budget? I mean, when you look at where growth is taking place as far as spending in a lot of colleges, it's administration. It's not on professors. And so, but you've got this whole system, this education system that's all geared to serve itself, right? You have the middle schools, the high schools, all telling the kids, the only way you can do well in life is if you go to college. You've got to go to college. And don't worry about the debt, because they show you all of these old charts from somebody who graduated from college in 1980 and how well he did in life and how his college debt didn't matter. So they get these kids. They tell them, take on all the debt. The kids go to the school. They take on all the debt. And then the school says, oh, yeah, we've got great graduation rates, and you're going to be employed, all of this. And then you find actually what they're now doing is saying, well, the BA isn't good enough. Now you need to stay with us and get a master's, or you need to stay with us and get a PhD if you really want to get a good job. Well, who does that serve? It doesn't serve the students. It serves the administrations. Yeah. And they know that the kids can't get out of the loans. They know the loans are easy to get. And they also know, and this is something professors, I'm hearing from a lot of professors, is huge chunks of the kids that are going to college today shouldn't be going to college.
Devin Foley, we're on a break. Thank you so much for the time this morning. We're on vacation next week. We'll work on getting you in studio sometime in the near future. But thank you for the time this morning. All right, coming up, we'll get to your phone call, 651-989-5855. Again, use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. We'll continue our coverage of the debate from last night. We're going to take a bit of a sidestep from that. Certainly curious to get his thoughts about the debate last night as well with the Democrats of night one. Representative Steve Drazkowski, who's been spearheading this looking into Ilhan Omar. We're going to get to Steve Drazkowski here in just a moment. We also have a phone call here on Justice and Drew, Twin Cities News Talk, as we continue to work through the debate last night. Just a quick question. We were talking with Devin Foley from Intellectual Takeout a moment ago. Canceling the debt? I haven't, now granted, I haven't read any sort of language about this at all, but is there any idea how that's supposed to work? So if you've got debts,
that's funny.
I know, right? So now here's my question. So let's say, for the sake of argument, let's say Sam's got a bunch of college debt, right? Mm-hmm. She's out of college. Let's just say she's out of college. Out of college debt.
She graduated. She's got $75,000 in college debt.
She embraces Bernie and Ilhan and says, "Cancel my debt." She cancels it. What about the individuals applying to college who are in college who are accumulating? What about everybody afterwards that continues to go to college? Are the colleges supposed to naturally just go and no longer charge as much? Or is this just going to be in perpetuity?
Well, most of the candidates that have brought this up have coupled it with, and we need to make college free.
Okay.
Higher education.
Okay.
Free. Okay.
Yeah. So this doesn't happen again. The colleges are, of course they love this idea because they know it's not free. They know they're still going to get a huge chunk of money for every student that they bring in. And that money is absolutely guaranteed because it's coming out of tax coffers. It's coming out of state governments. So what are they going to do? They're going to take in more students. They're going to compete for students. They're going to accept everybody and get that money. And they're not going to care about the quality of the education that they're putting out. Why would they?
Yeah.
Why would they care? There are no consequences for failure for the colleges. There's no consequences whatsoever for the failure of these colleges. This is taking an industry, all these higher learning institutions who, by and large, are doing a bad job. They're not doing a good job. A lot of them are outright failing, and rewarding them and say, keep doing what you're doing, guys. We're just gonna change where the money's coming from. That's all.
We'll get to the phone calls here. Let's go to our guest, Representative Steve Drazkowski. Before we first off, thank you so much for joining the show this morning. Before we dive into Ilhan Omar, would be very curious to sort of get your reaction to the debate last night.
Well, gentlemen, I'm sorry, but I was busy working.
Good for you.
All through last night, and so I didn't catch the debates. But I trust what the president had to say.
Yeah, yeah. I trust the parody video that he did when the power went out last night. God is not without a sense of humor.
So I wanted to bring you on because obviously this Ilhan Omar story has continued to slowly sort of grow, slowly sort of make its way outside of Minnesota and into some of the national media now that she's a member of Congress and not just a member of the state house. And you're the first one to have really brought up these campaign finance violations. You're the one that sort of sounded the alarm on the campaign finance violations that started a lot of this snowball rolling downhill. Is it gratifying to see it start to get some of the coverage that it really warrants, even if that coverage is not necessarily coming from within the state of Minnesota where it really should have been?
Well, absolutely. It's kind of been a long time coming. It was a year ago now when I sounded the alarm about Representative Omar taking money from three different Minnesota colleges in violation of Minnesota House ethics rules. And at that point, I just couldn't believe that the Minnesota media didn't, they were just flat dead, did nothing. And, you know, we've had to really shame them, I think, into action. Their really loyalty collectively, not you guys, but a collective loyalty to the Democrat Party and just their strong attachment to the PC culture, I think, has numbed them into inaction on this. But now they are being shamed into action by the fact that the national media is ahead of them on issues that are going on in their own state. So, you know, one way or another, the right thing usually does prevail.
Well, I guess that's sort of the next question. There's a piece from the Washington Examiner. We'll run through this after we're done speaking with you because you already know all the details. Basically, it's running through the official documents that signal all the discrepancies in Ilhan Omar's marriage statements. But where does everything go from here? You know, are we gonna get a full blown investigation to determine what the actual truth in all of this is? Where is everything right now?
Well, first of all, you know, I had a press conference the other day calling on my Congresswoman Angie Craig. Yep. to open a House ethics investigation and to push to have her security clearance and her committee membership on the Foreign Affairs Committee removed. And her response was, well, this is just a political stunt. So, you know, excuse me, but Congresswoman Craig, you can just dismiss it, but the reality is all you're doing is moving and pacifying your far left base when the rest of Minnesotans and the people in your district are not supportive of that type of approach. And the other thing is when, and we look at this, Representative Omar has a long history of not following the law, whether it's just lack of respect for the law or overall disdain for the law. If that same behavior happens in the future as a member of that committee with those security clearances and those breaches come forward, Congressman Craig's going to be in a kind of a weird position. So I don't think that was a good response from her. I expected better. But, you know, we really have to push for Congress, I think, to take care of their own in this situation.
It's not a good response from Representative Craig, and in fact, it's kind of a galling response when you think about the series of political stunts that Democrats on a national level have engaged in with this presidency based on an assumption of crimes that ended up not existing. You have a lot more than an assumption here when it comes to Ilhan Omar. You have hard evidence. We know she violated campaign finance laws. I mean, that much has been determined. We know that she filed fraudulent tax returns. That much has been determined. And there's plenty of evidence to indicate that she committed immigration fraud by marrying someone who is alleged to be her brother. There's a lot of evidence. So you have plenty of grounds on a nonpartisan basis, on a non-political basis. You have all the grounds and justification that you need to launch an inquiry, to launch an investigation, to launch an ethics investigation. And for her to just reply of, well, this is a partisan political stunt, tells me that she doesn't take this seriously at all. This is all about party lines to her, because I never heard her say anything remotely close to that when it came to all these investigations and millions of dollars that have been spent investigating, you know, what ended up being complete non-crimes by the Trump administration. That's really frustrating to hear that she dismissed it on a partisan basis like that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, given all the things that we do know about Representative Omar's past and the breaches of the law that she has committed and the breaches of ethics that she has committed, and there's a lot of them, and we don't need to go through them all this morning, but there's a bunch of things we don't know yet, and those need to be discovered. There's some really deep questions that need to be answered. Representative was running simultaneous marriages. I mean, she was running a marriage to Ahmed Hirsi from 2002 to today, as far as address records show, and there's a lot of different address records throughout that period of time. Each and every time it appears that Representative Omar and Ahmed Hirsi were living at the very same address throughout that 17-year period. And then parallel to that, or simultaneously, she was legally married to another person who many people believe is her brother, Ahmed Hirsi, or Ahmed Elmi. So that, and then, of course, she has been in a position to have to cover up the second marriage, the legal marriage to her brother, in order to allow her to make her way to Congress and allow her to stay on the Foreign Affairs Committee and allow her to avoid the scrutiny of the media. So it's lies and cover-up in order to cover up the inconvenient truth of that second and really weird marriage.
If this does indeed go forward and these things are vetted out and shown to be true, have you looked into at all what the potential consequences are? I mean, I've heard, you know, federal felony thrown around, things like that, specifically when it comes to the tax returns. Like, what sort of consequences would you expect or predict would befall Representative Omar if these things were vetted out and shown to be true?
I haven't completely analyzed those guys, but I've seen some of them in a variety of areas. You know, the tax thing, those are very serious consequences. Some people have, in the media, have dismissed it, saying, well, you know, the IRS never goes after people who, you know, file jointly with the wrong person. But the letter of the law says much differently than that. Some of them do have felonies attached to them. I mean, the prevailing notion here is that there was a some sort of either student aid fraud that happened, or there was an effort by Representative Omar to get Ahmed Elmi here and into North Dakota State faster and at a cheaper rate, because he would have been coming as an international rate at North Dakota State otherwise. Those all contain very serious consequences, and many of them are felonies.
Representative Steve Drazkowski, thank you so much for the time this morning. We'll certainly stay on top of it. Keep up the good work, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Take care.
Let's go to Paul in Burnsville before we go back to some more audio from last night's night one Democratic debate. Good morning, Paul.
Hi. I have a question regarding, you may remember last week there was a poll out of Quinnipiac that, I hope I pronounced that right, that had 91% to 94% of the Dems voting for any one of the candidates you see on the stage. And as a result of that heavy turnout in support of any one of the Dems candidates by the Democrats, they polls showed any one of them beating Trump in 2020.
Yeah, we saw those polls, and immediately a lot of outlets, even conservative and left-leaning outlets, and thanks for the call, immediately came out and said, yeah, and if you want to go look at polling data from any other presidential election prior to the year, right around this time, they all show the same thing. There were polls that were out there showing that Obama was behind. He was behind by double digits to Hillary Clinton for the longest time. I don't put any stock in those polls any more than I do that any of those candidates that they spent, 2 hours last night on stage are going to be here 6, 7, 8 months from now.
Yeah, it's really tough to look at polls. I mean, I don't want to dismiss polls entirely because they're a good snapshot of a moment, but
and they hold things up.
And they do hold things up. You know, they're a good snapshot of a moment in time, but it's impossible to look at a poll now and say, well, that's clearly going to, you know, going to affect the 2020 election, because we have no idea what the dynamic is going to be. We have no idea what's going to be going on in the country. You know, if the economy, you know, takes a turn for the worse, then yeah, the Democrat will probably end up doing a little better than they would if things stay as they are currently. If we end up in a military conflict, things will change. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that can change between now and then.
Well, you know, let's be honest here. When you have, you know, things like this that happen on stage during the debate, where Savannah Guthrie is asking, you know, Beto O'Rourke about the marginal tax rate, and you have things like this, I mean, Trump really should be worried.
In that vein, some Democrats want a marginal individual tax rate of 70% on the very highest earners, those making more than $10 million a year. Would you support that? And if not, what would your top individual rate be?
This economy has got to work for everyone. And right now, we know that it isn't. And it's going to take all of us coming together to make sure that it does. Necesitamos incluir cada persona en el éxito de esta economía. Pero si queremos hacer eso, necesitamos incluir cada persona en nuestra democracia. Cada votante necesitamos la representación y cada voz necesitamos escuchar.
I feel like, and this is just for me, I feel like I'm at Disneyland when you're in the park ride and they do the instructions in English and then they switch to again. Spanish. Yeah. And,
and okay, this moment, I just want to set the scene a little bit. The moment when the camera pans from just his face to, what is it? It's Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren in the background.
Yep.
Absolute instant meme. The way that they are side-eyeing him when he first goes into Spanish.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
It was amazing.
And then Cory Booker, a couple questions later, yep. Yeah, I could do that too.
Yeah, he started busting out Spanish too.
Cory Booker.
Yeah, Castro did it too. All started just busting out Spanish.
So, you know what,
it's
guys?
Just virtue signaling, man. That's all that is.
They're so woke.
They're so woke.
By the way,
Como está woke.
But hold on. They're not that woke though, because it's not the only predominant other like it doesn't matter. I don't even know why I bothered.
It's just them showing look what I can do. That was all that was. Look what I can do, teacher. Look at me.
They were like pinkies up in the air.
I mean, seriously, why isn't there not? I know there's not going to be, and I don't want to give them any ideas, but there's such an opportunity here for a Democrat to call all this. Like, right now, the Democrat primary candidates have put themselves in a position for somebody like a Trump on the left to step in and call out all this nonsense and still have their liberal cred. Yeah. Like, I hate to say it. Can you imagine an Al Franken?
Yeah.
Stepping into the middle of this and going, you guys are acting like a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. And there's actually candidates out, you know, that were on that stage last night or will be on there tonight that are capable of that. If they decided to go that route.
Yeah.
If they were just going to go, you know what? I'm not playing your games anymore.
Right.
I'm playing my own game over here.
Yeah.
There's absolutely an opportunity for somebody to jump out, like a Tulsi Gabbard, for example, hypothetically.
They won't, though. They're too scared. They're too afraid.
They're afraid of their own base.
They're too afraid.
They're afraid of their own base.
By the way, where'd the Starbucks guy go? Is he on tonight? Is he still running?
Howard Schultz?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wasn't he running?
Oh, I don't know.
I have no idea if he's still running.
He was still high on my list of an individual on the left who could cut through all this nonsense.
Way too many candidates. I don't know.
All right. We got more of this coming up. We'll also talk with the Minnesota GOP chairwoman, Jennifer Carnahan.